It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, Farm to Table Talk ends up talking about dreams, dreams that people are pursuing. They've had a vision, an idea, a passion that has to do with either growing food or eating food or, you know, restaurants, stores, and others, and connecting the dots between the growers and maybe sometimes addressing some critical issues. Well, my guest today ends up addressing more than one issue. I mean, she's contributing to people that need to have better nutrition. She's also contributing in ways that people that are just helping people out, but helping farmers too, dealing with food that might get thrown away, and we waste so much food in the country. But I'm going to let her explain it, because my guest is Susie DeYoung. And Susie has established La Soupe. Susie, we're just going to plunge in here, and I think the best thing, way to start is, what is La Soupe? How do you explain La Soupe?
I am a 35-year veteran chef, and I just got tired of the waste that I saw as a chef in the catering world. I was a pretty high-end caterer, doing very large events, that spent pretty much my entire weekend trying to figure out how to get rid of the food that would have been wasted. So I took that and decided to start a nonprofit called La Soupe, whose mission would be to rescue as much of the edible fresh food that we can through a series and a network of chefs, transform it, and then share it with those in our community in a food insecure that are food insecure, meaning they don't know where their next meal is coming from. So our clients could be anywhere from helping the food pantries out, helping a lot of the nonprofits that are doing awesome work, but they don't have a good, healthy way of feeding the people they're helping. We want to be the food service to a lot of these agencies that will actually utilize the waste that we see, creating fun, different, and nutritious food.
Well, let's describe the source a little bit more. So the produce that you have available to you, how would you describe it? Is it old? Is it ugly?
Both, probably, but a little of everything. So, I mean, sometimes it's a bag of apples. Has 12, what is it, baker's dozen? I don't even know,
right,
13.
Okay, right.
Somebody along the on the distribution side dropped the bag. The bottom of that bag has a bad apple. The rest of the apples are fine. They get thrown away. They get thrown to the landfill, or, you know, God, you know, hopefully it would end up in a pantry or something, but probably not. We love bruised anything, because you cut the bruise out and then you create with it, and it's food. I mean, the bottom line is it's still food, and in the hands of professionals, you can create. It's like almost like reverse creation. If you run a restaurant, you're constantly thinking of ways to get the very best product, mm-hmm. to simplify. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you don't want to do much to it because you want the product to shine. Well, we don't know what product we're going to get, but we want that product to shine. Same exact thing, but we have no idea what we're going to get.
So now, does this include pulling some from farm levels that don't meet standards?
Yes. So locally, especially when things start to come into season, like right now the zucchini and squash, it's out of control. I picked up 6 pallets last week of yellow squash, 6 pallets. One supplier.
Hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
All organic, coming out of the Amish country in Ohio, a CSA type of, you know, I quit asking why. Why are you throwing this out? And just say thank you. And we'll use it, and we're grateful to have it, and we will use it. But again, you know, part of the problem that we saw pretty early on is just capturing it is just part of the problem. Now what do you do with it? Because you can't, you know, you can drive into a food desert and set up a free produce table, but unless somebody's there to tell people what to do with the food, at no fault of their own. You know, they don't have the means to cook it. They don't have the knowledge. They don't have the equipment, the ovens, the stoves. So that is when we just said we've got to transform it ourselves and give it to them in a way that they can then enjoy it.
So the source can be from the farms themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
And so they can't, either they, it doesn't meet the standards of their customer or well exceeds what they've been able to market.
Normally, I would say local farmers are giving us their overages.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with, you know, if you have your tomatoes coming in, and, you know, tomorrow you're going to harvest again. You're going to hold them maybe for a day or two, but everybody's going to go for the, you know, the ripest, the juiciest, whatever. So they know what they can sell, and they give us what they can't. And then in return, if they want it, if they're composting on the farm, because that's what most of them would do with their produce, we give them our scrap to compost if they want it. They can come and pick it up. We work with a half a dozen farmers, but mostly pig farmers. So we're trying to give it to the pigs. But if the pigs don't want it, then the composters get it. Or if it was left in the sun too long you know, it didn't turn quick enough.
So what about at the store level? Stores, do they have product that's kind of getting close to how long they can keep it? Or doesn't it just set their standards as far as visually?
I think it's more visual than standards. I mean, how do you say that the romaine expired?
Well, you do, don't they? I mean, they say it's old now,
yeah,
we're going to get rid of it?
Right, but what does that mean? Is it food unsafe, or is it just not pretty?
I think it's like, well, if I stick it in my refrigerator and I forget about it, and you leave it in the plastic bag, it's kind of oily.
So. Right, that we would throw away.
Okay.
But a lot of times it's a matter of just peeling back two layers,
right,
and then you're fine again. So, again, that's why chefs make the difference. You know if you can use it or not.
Right.
If there's mold on fruit, you can't really cut that away without the thought that the mold has permeated the vegetable or the fruit.
What about large distribution, like food service distribution companies and so forth? Do they get some extra stuff?
Oh, yeah. So our largest one that I was saying when we got all the yellow squash is a wholesaler down in Kentucky that deals with all organics. So, though, you know, the irony is that the organic, honestly, that never looks prettier than the GMO'd.
Right.
The GMO is what makes it pretty.
Right.
So, or not makes it, but, you know, it's, you can tell one that has been injected or whatever, but the quality of the organics that we get, it's really almost comical anymore. Like, I don't understand it. I don't get it. It's peeling off layers of a wallpaper. Like, okay, we see one problem. Now we have another problem. Now we have another problem. There's just a lot of food being produced.
So around the country, other people have identified this as surplus.
Right.
And it is a big concern because we're wasting what? Like
40%
of all the food we grow.
Correct.
And we're worried about how we're going to feed the world with 9 billion people. But when you think of right now, we're basically wasting almost half of
it,
what we
right.
produce. So a lot of places are discovering, trying to get food like you're talking about. A big difference, though, for what you're doing is rather than just passing it out to charities, is that, explain that.
And we do, like, you know, if we have 47 partnering agencies. So we go to 47 different places every week. And if that person says, we have clients that could really use access to fresh food. They live in a food desert. They don't have access to fresh food. Can you supply some of it just as lettuce, as tomatoes and cucumbers?
Oh, okay.
We pack that. They want the soups to be able to take home or the stews. We do a lot of family meals for 4, 6, 12. They'll take, you know, we package that up and they take that home. And then we, you know, we pretty much, it's just a dialogue. And I think maybe it's not one size fits all for everybody.
But you do actually make soup.
Oh, yeah, by the gallons.
So explain that part of the enterprise, because I think people, again, can understand the kind of product you're describing and the fact that it can be distributed to agencies that are in need and people could use the lettuce and potatoes and whatever. But then what's this preparation
stage?
Well,
the soup part just is you can get a lot of bang for your buck in a bowl of soup.
Yeah.
And a lot of creativity. So as a chef, it was like, you know, one day was parsnip and potato. Well, yeah, any chef can kind of pretty much judge that would be a great soup. But what if we curried it? What if we coconut milked it? What if... So it's still fun to play with the products and try to twist it enough that, you know, we were going into, you know, different communities with the same soup. Not everybody likes the same soup,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
and...
Yeah.
So it, to me, like I said, it's a little more personal in the sense that we really try to create a dialogue and not be I was that person that, like, I would pack up my kids' toys and, oh, yeah, well, the doll didn't have an arm on it. Well, it's better than nothing,
right.
You know, that type of approach and take it down to Goodwill.
Yeah.
Well, I get it now. It's, you know, you're just passing your garbage on to somebody else.
Yeah.
And why not get it to people that will actually – do something with it and have the knowledge and have the other products, fresh herbs, dried herbs, you know, the coconut milk, you know.
So you have a kitchen and
very small kitchen,
a very small kitchen. And then, is there a certain amount that you're producing every week out of that kitchen?
Yeah, we have definite production numbers we're trying to keep. It's funny because when you start cooking for a lot of these clients, they roam. So one of the groups we do is Upspring, and that is homeless camps for the kids that parents are living in shelters.
Right,
they
right.
do summer camps.
Right.
Well, you know what? Some days they have 40 kids, and other days they have 140 kids.
Wow.
They're homeless. They don't know, you know, like the parents may have moved on. They're not in the shelter today. So you have to be pretty fluid about how much you're going to produce. But we do have PAR numbers and... it is constantly changing, but the way we grew it is probably what I think is the most important part is I can only feed so many people out of 900 square feet, 6 burners, 1 oven, and a tilt skillet. Well, the tilt skillet bit my finger about 3 years ago and smashed it really, really well. And I, again, had a huge delivery. I want to say 1,200 pounds that day.
Right.
And I put up on Facebook to all my chef friends, hey, you guys, this is what I'm doing now. Can anybody help me transform this food? Because I can't work for at least 2 weeks.
Right.
And the response was tears, because I could not believe how many of Cincinnati chefs said, absolutely, we would love to do that. So, and then after the crisis, said, well, you can send it to us every week. We can always fit in a batch of soup. So that's how we grew what we call our bucket brigade. The wish for being able to bring this to different shelters, but it normally was on a Sunday, right? Most of the shelters aren't open on Sunday. So even if you want to bring it to them, you can't. And then your work week starts back up on Monday. So I feel like a lot of chefs are like I am. Like, I would love to do good if somebody made it easy for me.
Yeah.
We're trying to make it easy for people to do in their kitchen that's Board of Health certified, that, you know, they're just going to use the excess that we bring them and their own, you know, sprinkling of whatever it is that they may have that could have gone to waste, create something, and then we will distribute that to the agencies in need.
Well, let's walk through that a little bit. So let's say you have a restaurant and you bring a certain amount of product over to them, and then they, what, in short order in the next couple of days,
right,
make the soup?
Yep.
And then how does it get
to
somebody else?
It goes to, it usually by volunteers. Mm-hmm. Primarily, the refrigerated, we have a refrigerated van that drives around the city and you'll see that out and about a lot. And a lot of times it's just one big run and we make a sweep through downtown. And again, it's not always that every restaurant can do it that week. Like, there may be weeks that they got a crazy event going on, they don't have time. And that, you know, the beauty of it is I don't want to say it's on their time, but it is on their time.
So you do have proteins in some of your products.
So the proteins we have never rescued, okay? Meaning I don't go to Kroger's and ask for that. We have the Free Store Food Bank here, and we have a lot of other agencies that have been doing this for years.
Right.
And I don't want that to, don't break it. It's not broken. They're picking it up. It's fine. And I don't want the deli meats and all of that. But what happened is I was doing a talk, and one of the ladies in the audience, her husband runs a company called Sugar Creek Brand. Sugar Creek is the single largest bacon producer in the country. They're a huge co-packer. So she decided to look internally. Like, I want to be on board with you, but I want to see what our company is doing with the waste that we know that we create. When she was shocked and she was mortified of how much they were sending to the landfill. Well, a lot of that product is nothing but, like, chicken that goes through. It's grilled chicken. I'm making this up. Let's say
sure.
that Arby's is her person.
Sure.
So they order 30,000 chicken patties that are hickory smoked. It goes mm-hmm. through the cutter. What mm-hmm. happens to the top of the chicken, the bottom of the chicken breast, and the two sides that has to be cut to make the perfect sandwich-sized
yeah.
chicken? It used to go to the landfill, but not anymore. Now Susie comes to the rescue, and we pick it up. So now we do have proteins that we can send. We have cheese from them, salami from them, chicken from them. Pork, adobo right. pork, a lot of odd products that you just kind of go, what? But you take it. And she has worked, the woman that I'm speaking of, has worked tirelessly to find large freezer capabilities so that these trucks can come in and take. And we're talking 40,000 pounds a month that
wow.
was going to the landfill, no longer. I think that to date is over 500,000 pounds just this year that we've kept out of the landfill. And that was all like stuff that normally we don't deal with it because I just want to get the stuff that nobody else wants.
Sure.
Because I feel like sure. other people can deal with prepackaged
yeah.
seasoned meats and stuff. You know what? They might be able to use that. But I want the stuff that nobody wants that really makes us think about creating something from nothing.
Well, you know, what a fascinating trip you're on.
It's eye-opening.
One thing, I want to go back to these chefs. I mean, you're tapping into some of the really good restaurants in the whole region.
Yeah.
And they are donating time to right. be able to put their creativity into making soups out of whatever it is
whatever
that's available.
Whatever it is. And it was interesting. Again, that was all out of an accident. And some of the best things in life happen by accident.
Right.
We know that. But I love some of the byproduct of that.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the chefs said to me, and he was one of the very first, and up until the day he left,
right.
they created every week. He was a weekly. And he said, but the beauty, Susie, that you don't understand that you've given us is you always have the new guy in the kitchen that wants to learn, but he's learning on food that was donated. Like,
right.
you're not allowed to create if you're the newbie, but
right.
now they can.
Yeah.
You know, you get the last guy in there, and they can get their knife skills. You know, take this case of squash and time yourself. You know, you can train easier, I should say, with people if you're not paying for the product that they're training on. You want to get a kid to learn how to do a brunoise, and
yeah.
the carrots are free. You're not going to jump him. And if he miscuts, you puree it. It doesn't really matter.
See, do you ever have chilled soups?
Yes. Yeah.
Because, I mean, it gets hot here.
Right.
And
We have a lot of gazpachos. I mean, this season, we haven't had quite as many for lots of reasons. I think it'll start back up. I mean, we do a vichyssoise gazpacho, a watermelon gazpacho, a cantaloupe gazpacho. Last year, one of my top-selling soups, which was funny, and it was, I have no idea why, but we got bombarded with nothing but apples and potatoes. So I'm like, I'm putting them together, and we called
apples
it
and
potatoes
in
Normandy
a chilled
style
soup?
Vichyssoise, and I
oh my gosh.
Deglazed it with some calvados, which really bumped up the nutritional value.
What's
and
that again?
Calvados. It's an apple brandy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it gave it a, it really did give it some
kick.
A kick, but interesting flavors. And then with the chives and the leeks, it was delicious. And I had somebody in last week that asked if we were going to be doing the apple vichy swap. And I'm like, that was like out of desperation.
So you're French heritage. What does vichy swap mean?
Presuming it comes from vichy, the town of Vichy.
Oh, okay.
My guess. And my father was French, and he actually brought the first five stars to Cincinnati. He was the Maisonette chef who brought the Maisonette five stars.
You know, one of the first times I was ever in Cincinnati, I went there to dine.
Of course you did. Everybody did.
I know.
It was the number one place to go.
Well, exactly. And you'd say, well,
for 40 years, nobody will beat that. Mobile five star for 40 years. And the byproduct of that, actually, is Jean Robert, who has, a nice little group of restaurants happening in Cincinnati, and French Crust is one of them, and French Crust produces for us every week.
Oh, that's incredible. Because one thing, my memory is, I've eaten at a lot of good restaurants over the years, and I still remember that experience. It was wonderful, but it was very French.
Do you remember what year or era?
No.
Recently, like in the 80s, you think? The 90s?
No, it was, it was probably just around 2000 somewhere.
Okay.
I remember the thing is that I just remember being in the restaurant because the atmosphere of the restaurant was fantastic. It had a maitre d', it had so much class and
so
style,
classy.
and the atmosphere was just wonderful. There's not many like that anymore.
I don't think. Yeah. He started a restaurant L, that was to try to bring that feeling back.
Yeah.
It's in the Great American Tower. There's people that love that style of dining, and then I think the younger generation has a harder time embracing it, but.
The hipsters a little more industrial seeming, and that's great. I like that too. But it was a different era.
It was.
And yet the other thing that strikes me though, that's kind of like bookends of your career, because if you can remember of that kind of restaurant that your father had, and what you're doing today, and some of the even the homeless kids that are getting some of the soup are having chefs that were capable of doing that sort of high-end French cuisine, and you're bringing it to them.
Right.
This is amazing.
Well, and I said one of the things, another byproduct, I didn't realize that some of the newbies now have food to work with. The chef isn't freaking out that he cut too big or too small, but he's learning on free produce. But the second is the kids that we started feeding, the very first school that I went to was Euler. And Euler is in the worst of the worst, lower price hill, dropout rate, like nobody's business. But they set up a pretty cool model that's now being done all over the country. And it makes it the community hub, the community center. So they have vision testing. They have a dental clinic. They have, they're making everything at the school so that, everything happens in one place. So they requested the soups. We started bringing them. The kid that, the reason we went there, I should probably say, is a Facebook post again by a teacher that, as I said, she outed the school or outed the problem,
right.
Which was there was no school on Friday in November because of snow.
Right.
So unannounced snow day.
Right.
The kids come back on Monday and it's mandatory test day.
Right.
And she couldn't find one of the kids in her class that she knew was in the building because she saw her. The kid was too weak from hunger to get up the steps to take this test because she hadn't eaten since Thursday's lunch at school. Friday, the power packs are given out by the Free Store Food Bank. And Friday, there was no school. So now these kids had nothing Friday, Saturday, Sunday. She showed up. It's not the dead of winter, but there had just been a snow day, in shorts, flip-flop, T-shirt, and hungry. So the teacher posted about it, and I kind of said BS, and I literally went rogue and threw a bunch of food in my car, threw an 8-foot table in my car and just said, I have food, I'll bring it to them. And I had tons of fresh fruit that day, tons, and found that that's what the kids really loved. I had some donuts. Yeah, they like, you know, I'm not stupid. They're going to go for the donut, sure. But they really were enjoying having cut up fresh fruit salad sure. in cups and take it. Interesting enough, nobody stopped me. I thought that was really interesting. Like, I think back to
right,
that now.
Right.
Like, how many days I was down there and nobody said, like, who the hell is that lady giving out food over there and why is yeah. she there? But it, you know, and then we developed the relationship with the school and got it organized to where we could say, yes, every Thursday we'll be here. If the free store comes on Friday, we'll come on Wednesday or Thursday so that they can bring more home. They can't take both if,
right.
you know, if it's one small child. Well, then the kids at the school asked for cooking classes.
Really?
So they said that they wanted to learn how to cook food now. So I didn't really have a whole lot of time, but I agreed to do it. So the cooking classes started like a normal cooking class. I met with these boys, and they said that if they don't learn how to do something after school, they're not athletes. Most right. kids stay right. after school to do athletics. They wanted to, they said, if we don't find something to do, we're going to sling drugs like everybody else. And we want to learn how to cook. Will you teach us? How do you say no to that? I really didn't have the time, but you can't look at kids that are really sure. doing everything they can to try to yeah. learn something that they might enjoy. So I went down there with another woman, Carolyn, who has taken over the whole program for us as a volunteer PS. So she, we go down there with my knives and my wine to deglaze my pan. I got called into the principal's office after the first cooking class and said, is it true that you brought wine and knives to a public right. school in Cincinnati?
Right, right.
Well, how do you deglaze a pan without wine? And how do you learn to cook without knives? And so we compromised, and she allowed me to keep bringing the knives, but no more wine.
Right.
So on the third day down there, the third Monday, I was asking the kids how they were going to cook this rice. Like, if you're going to use the stovetop method, or you're going to use an oven method, and I got nothing but blank stares. So it turns out that not one of those kids had an oven or a stove to go wow. home to cook. So why am I teaching them how to cook if they can't practice when they get home? I can teach all I want to teach. If anything, I felt it was a disservice, because I can show you, well, if you had this, look what you could do, but you don't have it, so sorry, you can't. You can right. only, like, pretend while you're here. So I went back, and I just thought about it, and I came up with Crock-Pot. So we have a program called Cincinnati Gives a Crock, and each of the kids in the program, through a grant, receive a free Crock-Pot. And then in that classroom, kind of just like a little meal prep hour, right. we bring the food that they want to prepare, so they get to taste lasagna. I don't like it. It's got too much cheese. Well, then don't put so much cheese in yours. Like, they learn how to control, you know, too sure. spicy, or I don't like that flavor. That's dill. Don't put it in. I mean, right. you know, it's really rudimentary cooking. Again, a byproduct of that is one of my favorite quotes from one of the kids said, for the first time in my life, I'm the hero of my family. I cook. I bring home dinner every Monday for 6 people, and I'm the hero. You know, doesn't get any better than that,
yes.
you know? And again, it's using, for the most part, like, that's the hard part, because we do try to use as much of the rescued product as we can. But again, you're trying to prepare a cooking class
right.
for 15 kids in 7 different schools that week.
Right.
You got to be a little bit, you know, so we do have a grant that we use to uh-huh. buy if we have to buy. But even like the other day, we picked up spices, like dried spices from somebody right. donated cases. So we put them into little jars, and now all the kids in the classes will have a starter kit of spices that they can utilize and, you know, try. And then, you know, the beauty then is that the kids wanted a job then. Guess what? Now, hey, could I do this and make money?
You are giving so much to the community and to this idea. A couple things I'm wondering about. Do you see this happening in other areas around the country?
What I would love is that a La Soupe could pop up in any city And when you go in, your menu is never going to be the same, ever, because you never know what you're going to get. But what it stands for is this is run by a group of chefs accepting the challenge to do something with this food, create a beautiful product, and then give that product to those in need. I just feel like it's the right thing to do. I mean, it's the funding model. Like, smart people wouldn't have funded themselves the way I did because I was using my passion and not my brain. You know, I think in most communities, little small grassroots operations, I mean, we're trying to grow it so that it's sustainable and replicatable and duplicatable. I would love nothing more than to hand you a how to open the Le Soup in your city guide. That's my ultimate goal. And with that, I'll gallop off into the sunset and say, okay, my work here is done.
Who have you looked to that have given you ideas or helped motivate you to kind of take this down the road even further?
One and only. Well, not one and only. I have probably three. Three chefs that I say motivate me every day. Massimo Baturo, for sure.
Who is
the number one chef in the world, okay, voted number one chef in the world. But his mission is to build refectories, or which is like a soup kitchen with beauty and dignity, and they're just amazing. But he has a book, Bread is Gold, I got to make sure I say it right. And it tells a story of when he built his first refectory and calling on chefs at a food expo that he knew there was going to be a ton of food waste. He wanted his friends, his, compadres there to come and help him deal with this waste and feed the people that are most in need. So for sure him, Jose Andres, I'm part of his World Central Kitchen. He has created a network of chefs that will respond. I call us the Doctors Without Borders. So we're the Chefs Without Borders. We will go, in the case of any natural disaster, and be the first on the ground to feed people. We responded with the floods in Florida and Santa Van. We're part of that organization. I'm part of that organization, and I can gratefully say I haven't been called yet. I offered my services in Puerto Rico, but they were, you know, by the time we realized everything he was doing, I wasn't on the list yet. Now I'm on the list. But we went ahead and brought food to not only Florida, which was by our van, filled it, and got, I don't know, 1,300 sacks of food to people in need there. But then we sent an entire semi with Sugar Creek to Houston when theirs hit. And, you know, again, food that a chef needed. And Jose was in Houston, you know, so I said, we met by this truck. I just wasn't on the truck.
Wasn't he in Spain originally?
Yes.
And they came to New York.
And D.C. And then I just went to his fundraiser, which was called Dine and Dash, which is what he does in Washington to raise funds for World Central Kitchen. But he pretty much kept, not pretty much, he did keep Puerto Rico fed.
That's
through
amazing.
That and using the food that would not have been used. It was all there, like he said. Like, look, you don't have to look far. Right. There's food here. We just got to have people to learn, or the people that know how to cook to do it. And then, of course, my soul match is Jacques Pépin. And I've had the pleasure of chatting with him on the phone. We have an email affair that happens every now and again. And it's really because if you've ever read his book, The Apprentice, I think is the best autobiography ever written. And I think that because his life and my father's life were absolutely identical in so many ways, living through World War II, you know, why they chose the career paths that they did. He's cooking for the president of France, right?
Yeah.
Why did he come to America? What great restaurant is he going to work for? Howard Johnson's. He came to work for Howard Johnson's because he believed in the American family coming to the table. And that's what we're trying to do, is have food that families, you know, you have to sit at a table to really know somebody. And that the big icebreaker is always what's on the table, right?
Sure.
So his proponing of that and his love, his first restaurant on his own in New York City was a soup kitchen, not a nonprofit. but a for-profit called the Potagerie, which he said he had to close because of the skyrocketing rent, and there's not a lot of money in soup. But I'm hoping that we'll connect when I go to New York and next month.
What interesting stories that these people have. And you know what strikes me, too, is that what happens when you climb the mountain, when you're already recognized as one of the best chefs in the world, like in so many other areas, unless you figure out a way to give back, something's still missing in your life.
Well, and that's what actually at Slow Food Cincinnati, or Slow Food Cincinnati, Slow Food Denver, they have Massimo. Massimo was there and talking about food waste. And as I and they had a live stream, so I'm watching it, trying to, because I was too lazy to get up, and I didn't want to go grab a piece of paper and a pen, but I'm trying to write his quotes, and they were coming out so quickly that I couldn't even quote them, because they were, every single thing he said, I felt like I was in a locked closet with him, and he was just speaking to me, because it spoke so strongly to everything I believe. Like, what more do you want? He's like, I'm the best. Like, it's time for me to give back. It's time for me to be part of a solution that actually food is nothing but nourishment. It's food is what we need to live, and but food is life. And, I mean, his description of it, I was like, oh, my gosh, you are such a man after my own heart.
If you look down the road in this next several years, what are you most hopeful about, or maybe even optimistic, enthusiastic, as you look where everything you're involved with is heading?
The food waste issue is number one in everybody's, you know, food world, food waste. That is the issue. It's the hot topic. 4 years ago, it was not the hot topic. It was still buried on, you know, page 26. When the National Geographic and Time magazine and all these magazines put it foremost, front and center, I think what we're going to probably see is a lot of really super cool products using byproducts, because I think that's necessary. We're working on a couple of products that could help us be more sustainable if we can get the product to a brewer or a distiller that they can then turn into something that would benefit us and benefit the planet and benefit them. In the next couple years, it will be that we can see some Lasoups popping up.
People want to find more about your story. Where do they find you online?
LasoupCincinnati.com.
Well, spell it for people.
LASOUPE Cincinnati, CINCINNATI.com.
Okay. And, I'm still working on spelling Cincinnati right every time.
I know. CINCINNATI.
And then when you, and Lasoup. Does it have to be capital L and capital S?
No, all lowercase.
So just Lasoup, L-A-S-O-U.
It's just that people forget the E.
Right.
But if you Google it, it'll probably come.
I'm going to ask you to do one more plug, and that is for the book that you're holding on to that people can't see.
The Bread is Gold by Massimo Bottura and Friends. I encourage everybody to understand what's happening in a really beautiful culinary way is through this book. I can't say, and the proceeds go to his Food for Soul, so I love that. It's giving back. But more importantly, if you're not a cook, it doesn't matter, because the recipes, I haven't even read a recipe in it yet, but I've read it front to back, to hear each chef's story of what they found when they went in. It pretty much will just say, Susie went into the kitchen, and that day all there was zucchini. What did she make? And it's so you can really kind of get into the mind of the chef of what they're asked to do and how they do it, a little bit of their backstory, but I found it fast. I mean, for me, it's like book is gold, bread is gold. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, Lasoup is gold. You guys have done a fabulous job, and I really admire what you're doing, and people are going to enjoy checking it out more and following in your footsteps. And I really want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.